This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wherediddtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to the show. Tonight, I am airing the second part of my interview with David Politis. Part one aired last week. If you missed it, you can find it at wherediddtheroadgo.com in the archive section. You can also find it on YouTube and Vimeo and sites like that as well, if that's your preference. So tonight, we continue our conversation on David's series of books, Missing 411. There are four of them, and you'll hear us talk about how you should buy the books to fully understand this. This is not just this is not a plug for David. This is not just trying to sell books. This is just the case. If you look at all the cases in their entirety, you get a much different picture than if you just listen to an interview. It's not necessary in order to understand how strange this phenomena is. But there are hundreds and hundreds of cases in the books, and you're hearing, I think in the course of these two interviews, maybe about 11 or 12 of them. To get the full depth of how strange this phenomena is, you really do need to read them, and they're long books. Again, don't buy them from Amazon, because you will get ripped off. Go to canammissing.com, and you can also sign the petition there. You can also sign the petition on wherediddtheroadgo.com. If it's not on the main page, it'll be on the archive page for this show. And that is what we start out this week's interview talking about, is that very petition. So, with no further ado, here is part two of my interview with David Politis. All right, David, so you have this petition that you didn't start. I thought you did. And that is, it was started by one of your readers.
Yeah, she read the books and she understood essentially the same issues that we did, and that was that the Park Service isn't being very transparent with its facts. And isn't really being accountable for the missing people on their public lands. And if anything, they're trying to conceal the fact from the public. And what this petition is asking is that they be transparent. They put up a website. They don't even have to put up a website. They have to put up a link on their site indicating who is missing and where they were located at. And if it's not a hard thing to do, but then again, I don't know how many people are truly missing on their parks because we don't know.
Right, right. And it's not hard to do, especially considering the technology today. I mean, if this was the 70s, it would be one thing.
Exactly.
And people can sign this petition where?
So you go to my website at canammissing.com, look at the links at the bottom, scroll down, and you can find the petition and go on there, sign it, put on a few comments. We'd appreciate it.
And also people can find, obviously, the books there.
The books are there, and the videos are there. We've made three videos about three cases, and they've gotten some pretty good reviews, so please go take a look at those as well.
Okay. And what else is on the site? Is this where people can contact you?
Yeah, there's a link there for emails, and we kind of have a current events page where there's current cases that we're looking at or we're talking about, and on Facebook, I kind of revert people back to there where they can look at me and talk and bring up cases that concern them. I do tell people, though, that if you haven't read the books, kind of keep the cases and don't forward them, because there's hundreds of missing people every day in the United States, and we're interested in a specific profile that fits that missing case. And honestly, I get cases every day from people who have read the books that are pointing me in the direction of new incidents, and there are new ones almost every day.
Now, you don't look at missing people in urban areas, so why is that?
Well, originally we didn't, because the people out there that are the naysayers will just say, well, that's a human abduction. So we decided that we would stay in those rural areas or in locations where it would really take the human factor out of it. And initially there were some people that said, well, it could be a human abduction. Well, if it was a human abduction on the trail, then the dogs would pick up on it and their scent would be tracked. And trackers would pick up that there were two people walking together, and that would become evident real quickly. And neither one of those has ever happened. Then the third factor is that you have helicopters and planes that are flying the area with forward-looking infrared radar, and they're never finding anything. And then the last factor is that the people, if they are found, more times than not, they're found in an area that had been searched dozens and dozens of times before, and they're located the next day right in the middle of that area, which is a strange fact.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was one case I remember you said that they were looking for this girl, and they searched this farmhouse, an abandoned farmhouse. And then a huge storm hit, and they went back into that farmhouse right after the storm, and she was there.
So it could be that farmhouse, it could be a field, it could be a forest. It could be the main trail that the search and rescue people were taking every day to go out and look for the person. And in one instance in Sequoia National Park, a tree went down, and this little 2 or 3 year old boy was laying on top of the tree when they found him. So it's almost, as some people have said, it's almost as though they're placed there to be found.
Yeah. And then you have to ask, what's the motive of somebody who would take someone? They're not being molested or anything, as far as you can tell. There's none of these reports suggest somewhat that these children are being molested in any way, despite sometimes being found without clothes, and then they're put back.
Very strange.
And I mean, it's hard to think of a motive for it.
Well, some people have said, well, maybe for the kids, there's some kind of play toy for somebody. But then again, others have brought up that, and we've known about this for a while, is that when you have there's a lot of kids that have disappeared that have severe disabilities, severe mental disabilities. And then on the opposite end of that intellectual scale, you have people that are absolutely brilliant that have disappeared. And when you look at the disparity between the intellect of those two people, what's the common ground there? The common ground is that they're both unusual aspects of the brain.
True. True. Well, let's throw a monkey wrench into anyone who's thinking they may have had this figured out and talk about the case on the boat in Florida with Al Snyder, C.H. Trotter, and Don Fraser.
And boy, there's a paradigm shift that when we first started to look at it, we even took a hard swallow and said, well, but if it fits the profile, we've got to look at it. And where everyone thinks, oh, I know exactly what's causing this, and the people that even still say that, I know they haven't read the books, because this is one of those cases where it does throw a big wrench in things. But Al Snyder was one of the best jockeys in the world. The incident occurred March 5th, 1948, and just prior to his disappearance on this boat, a very famous thing is he rode Citation, and he won the Flamingo Stakes at Hialeah Park just before this incident. Well, the day before the incident, March 4th, he was offered full-time employment by a group called Prestigious Calumet Farms, and he was essentially destined to ride Citation in the Kentucky Derby. That's his life was set. Well, he went out with Trotter and Fraser on a big luxury yacht, and they were off the coast of Florida, very near Everglades National Park, right on the fringe. And it was the afternoon of the 5th, and those three, Trotter was a horse trainer, and Fraser was a Canadian manufacturer. They got in this little boat off of the yacht called the Evelyn K, a 65-foot yacht that was owned by a guy named John B. Campbell, who was secretary of New York Racing. And this little boat pulled into what's called Sandy Key. And the three men were in this 15-foot wooden boat catching redfish. And they were within sight of the big yacht. And within minutes of them getting set, a big storm came in, big winds, huge winds, big waves, 45 miles an hour, It toppled a 70-foot elevator tower in Miami Beach, and the storm only lasted for 1 hour. Now, Sandy Key, where they were fishing, it was so shallow, they could have gotten out of the boat and the water wouldn't have been to their waist. But they disappeared when the storm came in and the big boat couldn't see them anymore. They just were gone. Well, the big boat calls the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard contacts armed forces and immediately asks for assistance. And they were the only group to disappear in this storm. And the effort to find these guys was nothing short of the biggest I've ever heard of. They put out 30 planes, boats, blimps, helicopters, everything. And they went after it for a week, and they found the skiff 10 miles south of where it disappeared. And it was overturned in a place called Rabbit Key. The life preservers that were in the boats were gone. Everything in that skiff was gone. Well, on March 16th, about a week and a half after they disappeared, an Army helicopter was inside Everglades National Park flying and looking down low in a mangrove swamp form when it crashed. And the reason I bring that up is that it was about this time in the research that we started to think, you know what, there's a lot of planes that are crashing in relationship to these searches. And I write about it in the book that it's an aerial phenomena in relationship to these people that I've got to put down. Well, again, the bloodhounds came in and they searched the area where the boat was found. They found nothing. And it was a disaster. These three men were great men and nobody ever found them. And kind of the epilogue to the story is one of the most famous jockeys in the world, Eddie Arcaro. He was invited to go fishing by Snyder. They were best buddies. And he couldn't go. And when Snyder disappeared and they couldn't find him, Calumet Farms got Arcaro to ride Citation, and he rode him to the Triple Crown. And in an absolute, a notation of great sportsmanship, Arcaro gave half of his earnings to Snyder's daughter.
Nice.
You don't hear about that stuff very often, but it needed to be said.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, is it possible that the large waves just washed them out to sea?
Well, it would have washed them inward in this key towards the coast rather than away with the way the winds and everything was blowing. So when they found that boat 10 miles south outside the key, it didn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people.
Hmm. And you also mentioned in this book you have a case where like a cave diver, underwater cave diver goes missing. So, I mean, it's not just in the woods and in mountains at this point.
Well, and the cave diver is one of the greatest whodunits, I think, in any book I've written about because there was no place for that guy to go.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go on.
And, I mean, the search for him was one of the biggest underwater searches in history. And those guys essentially staked their life that he wasn't in there. And that was the last place that they saw him go in. So where did he go?
Well, that's the key question to so many of these is where did they go? Even when they come back, where were they?
And they can't tell you because they don't know.
And when they do tell you, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense, really. I mean, we discussed before the kid who saw cows when there are no cows anywhere around.
So there was another case I had, and I don't remember it off the top of my head, but a little boy said he saw little tiny cows.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that one.
And in a stroke of brilliance, one of the guys in the room said, Dave, think about that. Now, what would a little kid say if you put him up 500 feet in the air looking down, he would say those are little cows.
True. Interesting. And I think the all-time weirdest one that you had was the one who found himself in a cave with a replica of his grandmother. And we talked about that last time you were on about a year or so ago. And it just, the story he told was completely bizarre.
That was a bizarre case. And it probably fed a lot of people's beliefs, because I've had people tell me, well, you know, there's a lot of these underground caves that you guys don't know about. And that could be true, but I've talked to some spelunkers before in areas of these national parks, specifically Yosemite and Sequoia, and these guys say that they know every cave in the area, and they've been in every cave, and they've never seen anything strange. So maybe there's places that they don't know about, but that would be hard to believe.
Right, right. One of the cases we're going to talk about, Lillian Carney, and she had one reference, at least, to what happened to her when she was gone.
Yeah. And again, a lot of these young kids that do survive have some interesting things to say. She was from a small city called Massardis, Maine, 6 years old. This goes back to some of that historical perspective. August 8, 1897, at about noon. Think about the far north section of Maine. It's 15 miles west of the Canadian border, 10 miles west of Aroostook State Park, and it's a region that's surrounded by lakes, rivers, and ponds. On August 8th, she and her parents went blueberry picking.
And there's the berries again.
Yes. And they only were there a short period of time, and again, the parents say she just vanished. Well, they searched for an hour, and then they looked around, and they got some people that lived in the area to help them. And that first night, there was just a limited response. And by the following morning, they had 200 searchers there, and all were walking, yelling for the girl. And I want everyone to think about this. When searchers are out in the field and they're looking for a small child, they're calling for them by name and, hey, we're your friend. We're here to help you. We're here to find you. And none of these searchers ever get a response. So if you were lost and you were cold and you were in need of assistance, you're going to respond. But these people don't. You got to keep that in your mind. Well, on Tuesday, about 300 area residents arrived to search, and 10 a.m. that day, a guy named Bert Pollard was somewhere between 2 and 3 miles from the point where her parents last saw Lillian, and they found her. And there wasn't a lot of detail on where she was found, but Lillian didn't say a lot, but she made one interesting statement. And I keyed on it, everyone keyed on it, and she said, "The sun shined all the time while I was in the woods." Now think about that. That's a pretty weird thing for a six-year-old to say.
Yeah.
So the weather at that point, and it stated in the article, was partly cloudy and where she had been. She had spent 2 nights outside, and she was gone 46 hours.
And yet it was always sunshine.
Yeah.
And it's not something that a kid's just going to say. I mean, there has to be something they're referencing.
Yeah.
I mean, whether it be literal sunlight or something else.
Is she just in an area that has very bright lights, and she is perceiving that to be sunlight? Don't know.
And for the time period, you're not going to find areas like you do today with very bright lights either.
No. Very strange. So,
and some of the old cases are very, very odd that you've come up with. And I mean, unfortunately, you can't do a whole lot of research with them because they're so old. But the newspaper reports, I mean, some of the distances some of these kids have traveled is just phenomenal.
Well, there's a part in this book where I have a chart of distances traveled and the ages. And I think that put a lot of naysayers to rest, because it wasn't just one isolated case, but there's many cases where kids have traveled so far, it's beyond belief.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Up and down mountains.
Yeah.
When they can barely walk.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, because sometimes, you know, I've had people who have children say, well, my two-year-old can totally go a good distance. But when you're talking about through the wilderness and up at the side of a mountain, that's a little bit different than running, you know, across the lawn.
Or down the street to see a friend.
Right. Now, one of the things that's been brought up with young children being searched for, is it possible that they're scared of the search parties because they think they're in trouble, and that's why they're not responding?
And that is a concern that searchers have when they're out there. That's something that are talked about in search and rescue circles. you know, a lot of kids believe that, you know, you're not supposed to talk to strangers and et cetera, et cetera. Some search and rescue groups will allow a parent to go out with search and rescue teams and call out for their child. I think that's a good strategy. And others believe that the parent shouldn't be involved in the search. I think that's a bad strategy, especially when you're dealing with small kids for that exact reason. But aside from that, you got to go back to the facts. When you got helicopters and planes flying with FLIR that are going to pick up any heat signature on the ground, when you have dogs that are smelling on the ground for that specific scent of the child and they're not finding it, and you got trackers looking for footprints on the ground and they're not finding it, it's hard to say where they are.
Now, one of the things I was curious about, on your first two books, you said you left out Florida and Texas because of the sheer number of accounts. Now, did you ever go through those? You've added some from Florida and Texas in the later books.
So there was a stack probably 4 inches high of disappearances from Texas and Florida, and it was huge. But when you get down to the data and evidence, really only, you know, probably 10, 15, maybe 20 cases from both those states ever fell out and showed to be valid. So I did include those, I think, in this book and some in North America and beyond. And those were the ones that fit that profile. And there weren't that many as you would think.
So how many, what's the percentage of cases you go through versus cases that fit the profile? Like roughly?
Wow. I would say 10% or less.
Okay, that's what I figured. So you're looking at all these cases and just throwing most of them out.
Yeah, for sure.
What is the minimum that it would take for you to include a case?
So, you know, you got to use a lot of common sense in this. I mean, first of all, if it's in a cluster area, that's going to get my attention. It's going to get the attention of anybody doing this research.
Right.
And a lot has to do with the age of the person. And again, it's at both ends of that spectrum. There aren't a lot of people disappearing between the ages of 30 and 50. But there are a lot of young kids and a lot of old people that disappear.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And then you have the intellectuals. If I get, say I get a case in Yosemite National Park, a 65-year-old physicist disappeared, I'll be all over that. Or you get a 6-year-old boy with autism that disappeared in Crater Lake National Park, which happened. And there's an entire series of young boys that have disappeared at Crater Lake and never been found. So, I mean, it helps at this point having the knowledge of these areas that we have. At the beginning, it was hard. But with time, it becomes pretty evident when you look at certain facts.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. And then you do have cases from all over the world. And you mentioned the last two books, you mentioned a bunch of them.
And again, it's always easier to get information from the UK, Australia, Canada, and the US. That's pretty easy to get. Then you start getting outside those bounds, and in the last year, probably Facebook has helped me the most contact people in other parts of the world who have heard of the work and have ordered the books, and have said, hey, have you ever heard of this? And they point me in the direction of a news article I never would have heard of before, but it's a dead ringer for what we're looking at.
Now, do you ever have to request information from foreign countries? I mean, can you do that?
So that's an interesting question. Canada has almost the same law we have regarding the Freedom of Information Act, but it only applies to Canadian citizens. So you have to be a Canadian citizen to force their hand to give something up. Now, in truthfulness, I've gotten extreme cooperation out of the RCMP in these rural areas. A couple of times I called them directly and had a phone conversation with them, and they said everything. There's a young guy and a young woman that disappeared out of British Columbia. She was a medical student and he was an attaché for Quebec, and they'd been dating a long time. They disappeared into the unknown reaches of British Columbia. His mom contacted me and said, Dave, I really think this is a match. We'd already been looking at it. It was. And I contacted the RCMP, and they were dumbfounded. They said, Dave, We have no idea what happened to those people. We haven't found one stitch of anything that belongs to them except their car at the trailhead. We don't know what could have happened. The canines didn't pick up anything. On and on and on. That's a dead ringer for what we're looking at. But you talk about cooperation. I think it's all contingent upon the personality of the officer handling the case, and they're willing to be open about it.
And I know back, I want to say it was published in the 70s, Brad Steiger had written a book on missing people, but he, all different types of legends and stories about people going missing. But one of the things he talked about was a forest in Germany that fit. Basically, he isolated out a lot of the same things you're isolating out on a worldwide basis just for this forest. Have you ever heard of that?
You know, I've heard minimal about it. Maybe one or two emails in the last 6-7 years. And if anything has happened, I haven't heard about anything recent.
Ah, okay. It's almost like he may have touched on something that you really expanded on back then, but just never ran with it, never, focused in on it in any way. It just became a chapter in his book.
Right.
Because the forest was known for people disappearing in weird circumstances.
Huh.
Also, on the topic of young children disappearing, it seems like a lot of times these kids disappear when they're hanging out with their older siblings, and the older siblings go, "You can't be here, go home." And that's when they seem to disappear. I mean, it's possible they're wandering off to some degree, too.
Well,
even though that may not be the end solution, but it may start off with them being upset and wandering into someplace different.
Or it also goes back to that last on the trail. If, and this has been brought up 100 times to me, so I'll just say what other people have said. Dave, it's almost as though something is watching and waiting for an opportunity when they can take somebody that's alone. So let's say a bunch of kids, more times than not, kids are disappearing at their grandparents' or their relative's house. And that's a strange dichotomy that we understood a while ago. So the kids are visiting, they're in the yard, they get separated from the group, just like you're last on the trail, and they disappear. There was a case out of Australia just within the last 6 months where a husband, a wife, and their two kids were visiting their grandparents in a house that abutted the forest. The daughter said, and these are like 3 and 4 and 6 year old kids, and they were saying that, he was right here a minute ago, and the next minute he was gone, and I don't know where he went because he was just here a minute ago. And his last name was Tyrell. And again, they searched for weeks and they never found William Tyrell. And it was an exact case that I could replicate 50 times that's happened in North America, almost under those exact scenarios. And when it was going on, like the second or third day, I told my friends, I said, "Hey, this little 3-year-old boy, they should find him within a day. And if they don't, I don't think they're ever going to find him." And they never did. And again, visiting relatives, playing in the yard, disappears on the edge of a forest, and is never found. And that house that he disappeared from was at the end of a dead-end court. And there were some implications made by the Australian police. You know, maybe an abductor came in there, but as somebody who's worked abduction cases as a law enforcement guy, that would have been the last house that any criminal would ever pick to take somebody from, because there's one way in and one way out at the end of a court.
And that's saying we didn't mention at the beginning of the interview, you were in law enforcement for 20 years?
Correct.
Okay. And so you did work missing people's cases and such?
You know, towards the end of my career, there was a famous case called Polly Klass. And Richard Ramirez abducted her from the inside of a house in Petaluma, California. And the head FBI agent that was working that case, that was assigned it during the first couple days, was a municipal law enforcement officer before he was an FBI agent. And he knew another detective I worked with, and he said, "Hey, you come up here and bring your best guy that you have, and I want you guys working with me. And I say this all the time, the FBI has the best forensic teams in the world and the best analysts in the world and the worst street-level investigators in the world, because they don't get the experience working on the street, talking to people, and getting the evidence that you need to get. And so this guy that was head of that task force brought us up and a few other officers to work that case with him. And I can tell you that it was horrific, just because Mr. Class was just taken through the wheels by Ramirez in court, called a child molester, et cetera, et cetera. And his daughter was telling him how much he liked her and she hated his dad. And I mean, for a dad to sit there and take all this in court, it was unbelievable. So, Yeah, I worked that case.
Wow. All right. So let's look at a case that gives us a little bit of different evidence as to what might be going on. Jackie Hellman.
Yes. What would you like to know about Hellman?
Well, what's interesting is one of the things that they found is it looked like Hellman was dragged through the snow.
Okay, so that occurred January 2nd, 1941. Jackie Hellman, 6 years old.
Jackie.
Badger Pocket, Washington, little tiny place 15 miles north of Yakima, kind of inland. And a lot of these things are happening in the late afternoon hours, 3 p.m. or later. This happened at 3 p.m. And again, Jackie was in the backyard playing with a BB gun. And his dad or his mom said, oh, what are you going to do? And he says, oh, I'm going to go shoot a pheasant. And they turn their back and he's out of sight for a couple minutes, and all of a sudden, boom, he's gone that fast. Well, within a few hours, they had 50-plus people looking for him, and there was light snow that was falling, and there was already snow on the ground, and they thought they picked up the tracks, but they weren't sure, and they started to comb the area. Now, you go one day later, it's freezing cold, obviously all night, it's still snowing, and searchers were 8 miles away. Now, first of all, I have no idea why searchers would have been 8 miles away, because looking for a six-year-old, that's so far outside the bounds of anything in search and rescue for that age bracket, especially in inclement weather. But they found him curled up under a tree, and he was found just after midnight, and he was with his puppy. Now, he took his coat off and put it around his dog, and the searchers said that Jackie's body was so warm it would have melted the snow around him. Now, he's found 8 miles uphill in a little over 9 hours. What's important about this are a few things. Now, we talk about people taking their clothes off. Well, Jackie took his coat off, but also searchers said that his body was super warm. Now, why would his body be really warm? What did he go through that caused this elevation in his own temperature? And he was so warm that he was concerned about his dog.
Right.
So you couple that with 8 miles by a six-year-old uphill in the snow. Pretty hard to understand.
And I believe they said they found tracks that looked like he had been dragged.
Yeah, he had a weird stride that they talked about in the report where he was either being drugged or he was walking on his shoes in a strange way.
Huh. And if he's that warm after being outside and that cold, that's not really possible unless he was burning up with fever or he wasn't outside that whole time.
Exactly.
And even burning up with fever, the cold should have taken enough of a toll on him that he couldn't have been that warm.
Yeah, what do they do with small kids when they have high fevers? You put them in a cold bathtub, right?
Yeah. Now, did they actually check him medically after that?
You know, if there was, I couldn't find any notation of it. And again, it's one of those 1941 cases. It's hard to find anything on it.
Right. So do you end up going to, like, libraries and looking through old vaults of newspapers and stuff to find details?
There's all kinds of things like that I've done in the past. I mean, with Yosemite, I spent weeks in a library just outside of Yosemite in a couple different counties going through archives. And again, if you find an old librarian that's been there forever, they can be a huge, huge help. And every once in a while, I've gathered them as help and assistance. And then every once in a while, they'll tell you about somebody in the community who, hey, this person retired and they worked inside the park for 25 years. You might want to talk to them. And then that leads to something, which leads to something. I mean, it's, again, it goes back to having good relationships and being willing and open to talk to people.
Yeah. And you haven't gotten complete resistance from national park people. It's just in certain cases.
So it's very hard if you spoon feed them the information for them to say they don't have it. But even in some of those cases, they refuse to give it up. Famous case in my first book, case about Stacy Aris, 14-year-old girl who disappeared in the park. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request. It's listed as a missing person. She was with her dad. She disappeared. Make a long story short, I get a call from the National Park Service investigator asking me why I wanted the case. And I said, well, under the Freedom of Information Act, I can request it. And he says, well, why do you want it? Well, according to the Freedom of Information Act, they can't ask you why you want something and use that as a determining factor in if you get it. And I was really polite. I said, well, his name was Yu. Why Yu? I said, Mr. Yu, I'm a law enforcement guy. I'm interested in these kind of things. I just want to see it. And he told me flatly, he goes, you'll never see it. I said, is it a criminal case? No. Are there any suspects? No. I said, has anybody looked at the case in the last 15 years? No. I said, then why wouldn't you give it to me? You're never going to see it. That's all he said.
Do you think that there's an organized effort to keep these things quiet, or do you think it's just happening on a case-by-case basis where someone looks at the case and goes, yeah, we shouldn't put this out?
So what I tell people is that I think that there is an organized effort to keep the massive amount of people that have disappeared out and away from the public's presence. And I don't think that the rank-and-file National Park Service rangers have one iota of a clue as what is going on. And I would say they are the rank-and-file, the greatest people of the public that are doing yeoman's work out there, and I'd give every one of them a hug if I could. It's that probably, I'm guessing, 3 to 5 people at the upper echelon of the Department of the Interior that are really making these decisions of keeping this info away. And there's, on our website, I talk about another website that is actually was developed by a group of National Park Service rangers. And they talk about how they have had problems under the Freedom of Information Act getting information from their own agency and how they've been steamrolled and how they've been obstructed and how they think that the law has been violated and not giving them information. And in fact, I've talked to the guy several times, and it's like, yeah, he goes, there's complete obstruction going on, and no one cares. No one wants to do anything about it.
And of course, in a sense, it's kind of big business for them. If people start getting nervous about going to national parks, they're going to lose a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, again, unfortunately, in our world, money, it all comes down to money.
The sad part about it is that the Freedom of Information Act was a law that was enacted to give us, that private citizen, exposure and access to public documents so that there would not be a world of corruption and deceit. Yet what is transpiring now at different levels is just by not giving it out, the first place our mind will go is that bad area.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. All right, so there's another case. Instead of dealing with children, this is someone who was a little bit older, not very mobile. This was Hildegard Hendrickson.
Yeah, Hildegard is, she fits the profile of several people, namely women, that have disappeared under unusual circumstances. And what I say is at the back, if you're looking at them from the back, and this is not to be demeaning in any way, but if you looked at them from the back, it could have been a male or it could have been a female. Because Hendrickson had very short hair, was rather overweight, and you know, it could have been a man or it could have been a woman. And at the when we started to get into this, we said, well, maybe somebody is making a mistake and they really don't know what they're taking or what they're going after. But Hildegard was in the area of Wenatchee Lake, Washington, June 8th, 2013, at about 5 p.m. She was a world-famous person for her ability to collect mushrooms, and she was a member of several organizations. And again, she was on this brilliant level. She was a professor at the Alber School of Business at Seattle University. Super, super smart lady. Well, she had been collecting mushrooms and often did this on her own. It just so happened she was going to tell her friends that she was going out to this area near Wenatchee Lake and Chihuahua River Road. And she said, yeah, I won't go out there alone, I promise. Well, she did go out there alone. And it was in an area where there were tons of morel mushrooms. And she parked her car. She left it unlocked. She left her purse in the car. And she took a bucket and some walking sticks, and she went into that area. Well, several people reported seeing her, including a physician that said that he had a conversation with her. Her friend said that she wasn't real mobile, so she wasn't going to go out of sight of her car, especially since she left her purse in it. And not only did she go out of sight, they searched for weeks, and they didn't find one iota of evidence of her being in that area. They didn't find her sticks, her bucket of mushrooms, anything, her glasses that she was wearing, nothing. Now, this area around Wenatchee Lake is a hot spot for people that have disappeared. And I can't express to you enough that mushrooms are one of those kind of things with berries that seem to be a key factor on people that have disappeared. And in Hildegard's case, probably the most astounding feature is that if somebody was bowled over, let's say there was a mountain lion that took her or a bear wanted to eat her, where's her sticks? Where's her bucket? And this is the common theme on all of these people that disappear. They don't find anything. And she's not going to walk far because she's not mobile.
Right. And didn't the researchers say the area itself is just very strange and gives an odd sort of feeling to it?
One of the guys that did go in on that search contacted me. We had a long conversation. He said the place was strange to begin with. I mean, it's real thick, lots of mushrooms. He said that the one strange thing they heard is they heard a strange whistle when they were in there. And he said the searchers said that they should have been finding things and they weren't. There were 8 different dog teams that went in there with different breeds, all extremely experienced. They never found a scent. They didn't find anything.
Would you say at this juncture that you really have any idea what's behind this phenomena?
Well, people ask that daily. And I would say probably the one thing that's not part of the phenomena is I don't think humans are. I mean, I don't see a way that a human could be a perpetrator in any of this.
Right. And we mentioned earlier, people will sometimes suggest serial killers, but that's very easy to rule out.
Exactly. I mean, let's say somebody wanted to abduct Hildegard. Well, you've got a trail that's pretty busy, and there were 3 or 4 people that said they were on that trail and came out and saw her and spoke with her. So you risk being seen. It wasn't a robbery because her purse wasn't taken. And if there was a struggle, she's a large lady. You're not going to spend the time picking up her bucket and her sticks and to take her and risk being seen on a very public trail like that doesn't make sense. And if you did do that, then the canines would pick up on that scent and trail it out. But they didn't.
Right, and there are plenty of cases where people are kidnapped that you could show just that. It's easy to track at least the fact that they're kidnapped, if not figure out who did it.
And then the bottom line is, you know, motive. Why would anyone be on these trails and attempt something like this? I tell people that I live out here in Colorado, and Colorado probably has as many disappearances as any state in the union except except California, and we have a lot of disappearances in Colorado. And I can tell you that if it was a person that was doing this, there'd be some dead suspects out there, because the majority of the Colorado people are carrying guns on trails.
Yeah, true. Let's move on to George Carter, because this one's very strange.
Yeah, very strange incident in a very strange location. So that happened on May 21st, 1950. Again, a 3 p.m. disappearance. And it occurred on Mount St. Helens, and this is pre-explosion. The mountain erupted in 1980, so this was way before that. So Mr. Carter was a Boeing employee, and he was a National Ski Patrol member at Milwaukee Bowl on weekends. And what that means is, if you're a member of the National Ski Patrol, you got to be a really good skier, and you've got to be really good at first aid. And they push to make sure that you can control dragging a sled behind you with a 200-pound person in it. So you got to be not only a great skier, but you got to be in really good shape. And Carter was. And he went up with a group of friends that were going to climb the mountain and then ski down the mountain. So they reached the top, and he said, "Hey, I'm going to ski down a little bit, go around this corner. I'm going to set up. I'll be your cameraman when you guys come by me." While the group was coming down, they didn't see him, and they saw that where there was some stuff down in the snow where it looked like someone had stopped, and they found a box where he had apparently taken his film out to load his camera. And they didn't find much else except some tracks going downhill. And the article said that they described what he had done as a wild, death-defying dash down the mountain, where no skier of his caliber would ever do. And he had to jump 2 to 3 large crevices on the mountain, and they followed his tracks straight down the mountain, off a cliff, and down into a canyon called Ape Canyon. Now, that canyon, they searched for Joe for 3 weeks. Think about this. They should have found something. His camera, his skis, his poles, him. They found nothing.
And why? What would cause somebody to behave like that?
So, again, a great skier, someone who would always ski under control. So he made a choice here to ski that way.
Yeah.
And they.
And it had to be something that severely frightened him for him to make a choice to ski like that.
Yeah, exactly. And those people said that they didn't see any other tracks in the snow, nothing unusual, no other secondary skis were with him. It was just him going straight down the hill.
Yeah, that one's just so bizarre. And the fact that he was never found, I mean, at least if they found him at the bottom of the cliff, that would be something.
Yeah, and you know, if they would have found him at the bottom of the cliff, that kind of would have fit in with a lot of the other incidents that we've talked about where people are found at the bottom of the cliff in unusual and weird circumstances. But in this case, they never found him, which even adds more weirdness to the story.
Now, have any of these cases you've written about, have they ever, I think in the third book, you mentioned a couple that had resolutions to them. Have you found any others that more information has come out and you've been able to resolve what happened to the person?
Not really. Okay. Other than, say, on the McGrogan case that we talked about earlier, where you could watch it on YouTube, there's a couple of those cases where just pure luck that we stumbled into something that was obscure, like McGrogan not having his boots on. Now, think how strange that set of facts are, yet it's not in any of the 100 newspaper articles. It's not in the press release. It's nowhere to be seen, but it's a fact.
Have there been any recent cases you've had that really stand out to you?
Recent? Well, I think that case in Australia, William Tyrrell case, that's pretty recent. And again, that boy's never been found. And off the top of my head, there's probably a dozen others, but the reality of it is that they're all kind of fitting in this mode that you've identified here, Soraya.
So nothing that really stands out as, wow, this one's really different from, you know, or gives you anything new information-wise.
I would say probably McGrogan's case is the one highly unusual case that isn't in any of the books, that's recent, that involves an intellectual, that involves losing his, you know, him disappearing, no explanation from point to point, and no boots.
All right. So one of the explanations people do throw out there, which is has some issues in itself, is that this could be a portal or some kind of shift to another reality or a wormhole or something like that. And whereas hypothetically, that makes sense. I mean, you have cases where people are suddenly disappearing in places they can't disappear, but if they were moving in a direction we're not familiar with, I guess you could say, that would may explain how they could disappear in an instant and come back in an instant. But the problem is we don't know what that really means. To say a portal to where? We don't know if these things really exist. But if they do, we would don't know where they're going.
And the question I always bring up when somebody talks about portals is, if it's indiscriminate and random, how come five cars going down the freeway just don't drive into a portal and disappear?
Right. Well, I mean, there is the argument that these portal areas are specific, you know, certain areas like the legends we'll talk about, you know, this boulder field has little people that abduct people and things like that. And I know you've mentioned some cases where people are out in the woods and suddenly everything looks different to them.
Correct.
And then they find their way back, and it's areas where they should have been familiar with, which, again, suggests that they've gone through some kind of shift of some sorts, whether it just be a effect on them mentally or if it's some kind of reality shift of some sorts.
And if somebody could tell me how those portals work,
yeah,
you know, it could go back into that facts are important category.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, with the storms, I mean, maybe however they do work creates, you know, bad weather. Maybe it has something to do with Wilhelm Reich's cloudbuster type theories.
Yeah, those are all good points that I wish somebody could explain with some factual context that would work.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, it would be a breakthrough if we could say, yeah, these things exist and here's how they work. But until we can do that, it doesn't, it's not a sufficient explanation.
And what the other thing I talk to people about is they say, well, how come you're not taking a firmer stance on really what your thoughts are about what's happening? And I want people to understand something, that the most important part of this is the ability to communicate with family and victims. And imagine if I come out and I say, okay, you know, it's prehistoric birds that are grabbing these people and carrying them from point to point and dropping them. And let's pretend that a family member loses someone and they Google my name, and that's the first thing they read on Google. This guy believes it's prehistoric birds.
Right.
Well, is that family really going to reach out to me and ask for some help or ask for my opinion about something or give me some insight as to what happened that isn't publicly available? I don't think so.
And I'm sure your view of what's happening has changed significantly from the start of this to now.
Well, of course. I mean, at the beginning, there was a lot more people saying, oh, you know what it is. He's just right, and he's trying to conceal facts here. He knows what's really happening. But I defy anybody to read all four of those books and tell me what fits the category for all these disappearances.
Yeah. And like I said, my personal feeling is that there's more than one thing going on, but it could be interrelated. Because it seems like some people are clearly being kidnapped. Because there's no other explanation other than something somewhere is taking them and sometimes putting them back and sometimes not. But it also seems like some people are just getting lost and sometimes making it back to tell us they just got lost, but lost in a way they shouldn't have been able to get lost.
Well, in a perfect world, I'd like to get all of these victims into a room at a conference and one at a time send them out with a team and go through hypnosis.
Yeah.
And see if we could figure out if we could get any of that memory back. I think that would be the perfect world.
one of the, and another case that, that kind of throws a monkey wrench into anything I think anyone is thinking is going on, is Cullen John Finnerty. And this is a fairly recent case from 2013.
Cullen Finnerty's case is one of the top five I've ever researched as far as the knowledge base I have on it. And I want to thank the Sheriff's Department for releasing the entire case folder and photos. And I didn't release the photos in the book out of respect for the family and such. But, yeah, Cullen was a 30-year-old, absolutely man-amongst-men stud. And it hurt me to write about this story because I could see a lot of parallels in life with friends I had growing up. And his disappearance was within very close proximity of a case I wrote about in a girl named Katie Flynn from Walhalla, Michigan, back in the 1800s. And there's another case involving Jacqueline Simons that I wrote about that was also close proximity to where Cullen disappeared. And I tell people, hey, there's a reason we study history. And I know a lot of people don't like to read about older cases, but it all shows a pattern for that area that may be a lot different than other patterns in other areas of North America. Now, and I will say nothing was normal about Cullen's life. We know more about this case than we know just about any other case I've done. And that's because of the report, interviews, and photos, and some pinging of cell phones that were done in relative proximity to this case. Give you some clarity about Cullen. He's 6'2", 240 pounds, a big, tough man. He graduated from high school and went to the University of Toledo as a quarterback. He redshirted that first year, meaning he didn't play. And then he transferred to Grand Valley State in 2002. And he was the quarterback that told his linemen, don't cause a penalty by trying to hold these guys from hitting me. Just let them hit me. I don't care. And then the coach heard this, says, what are you talking about? He goes, coach, I don't mind guys hitting me. Let them hit me. It's not going to hurt me. That's how his mindset was. He was tough. Well, he won championships his junior and senior year at Grand Valley State and passed for 11,000 yards, ran for 2,000 yards, had a 28-0 record for 2 years. And if you probably looked under the definition of tough, Cullen's picture should have been there in the dictionary. He played an entire playoff series with a broken collarbone. How could you do that? I mean, my world is hockey, and I coached hockey for years. My son plays Division I. I can't imagine playing any sport with a broken collarbone. He did.
Yeah.
And his was called the most successful college program in any history of football. In 2007, he signed as an undrafted free agent with the Baltimore Ravens. Later, he briefly played with the Broncos. And then he went and played pro football in Europe and came back and played arena football. He later met a volleyball player from Grand Valley State, Jennifer. In 2010, they married, and they had two kids, Caden and McKinley. In that weekend, Memorial Weekend in 2013, the family went to a rented cabin in the area of Weber Township in Michigan. That last day they were there on the 26th, Cullen said near the end of the day, hey, I want to go out one last time fishing, so I'm going to go out on the pontoon boat. You guys just let me off. And they said, okay. Put on his waders and a jacket. Family dropped him off on the pontoon boat near the Baldwin River and 40th Street. And they said that the trip would be no more than 45 minutes because it'd get dark. The river flows south from that location where they dropped him. At 9:27 that night, Jennifer received a call from Cullen stating that he was being followed by two men who were 20 feet behind him. He was in the boat. He said that they were on the bank, and he said that something was going to happen. Boom, the phone goes dead. A few minutes later, he says he's getting out of the river, and I'll quote this, I'm taking off my clothes. Phone hung up. Now, why would he say he was taking off his clothes? There's the first million-dollar question. Jennifer stated he sounded paranoid and scared. Other calls were received at 9:34 and 9:36 p.m. Again, he said he was being followed and he was nervous. And then he said he got to go. At 9:36, a call was made by his friend to call and asked where he was, and he says, "I'm not sure. It's getting a little rough. I think a couple of guys are still following me." At 9:27, previous to this, Jennifer got a hold of him and got him to look up his phone coordinates on his iPhone, and he was near South James Road and Coho Lane. And they were trying to figure out how he got to these different locations. Well, at 10:37, he hadn't showed up at the drop point. Sheriff was called, and the sheriff's office did some things that were remarkable here, and I admire them for doing it. Immediately, they called the cell phone company and pinged Cohen's cell phone. And what that means is that it sends a message to the phone to hit the towers that are closest to that phone with a location by looking at triangulation from different points and different towers. They got four different locations off the four pings that were 4.37 miles apart, essentially showing it's impossible to go point to point within the pings without crossing one of the roads in that area, meaning he wouldn't have been lost. Well, on May 27th at 12 midnight, the family found Cohen's boat floating near 40th Street in the river with one of the oars missing. Now, in a point of being honest about this, Cohen had had paranoid episodes in his past. And in fact, at one point he told his wife that he thought the FBI may be following him. And people didn't think much about it, but at this incident, when they didn't find him, people were talking about him being abducted. Two people called and said he spooked a Bigfoot and they took him. This is all to the sheriff's office in their report. Well, Grand Valley State had heard that he disappeared, and they sent a busload of players and coaches to search. And one of the coaches was interviewed, and he said, "Hey, I'll tell you right now, if two guys are following him, he doesn't care. He'll turn around, he'll take them both on, and he'll die fighting. He's not going to run. Something else is going on." That's what the coach said that coached him. Well, on May 28th at 7:49 p.m., they found him almost in the geographical center of these two pinged locations. His cell phone was in his front jacket pocket. They found him face down, which is, again, a common thing in all of these cases. The people are found face down. His left hand was clutching some debris. And right away, I keyed on this, and I think if you're a fisherman that wears waders, you'll understand this. The waders were crossed on his back coming over the front, but they were in a circle on his back as though they were twisted. And I know no fisherman would fish like that because it's uncomfortable. So it's almost as though somebody may have grabbed him and laid him down and twisted these straps as they laid him down. How do I know this? We have the crime scene photos. His nose was bleeding when they picked him up. They could see that. His body was first sent to Kent State pathologist. And Dr. Stephen Cole, I'll quote it, "No obvious signs of death." They couldn't confirm why he died. They sent the body on to the Boston University medical team, medical examiners. They stated a definitive cause of death couldn't be found. Now, there's a lot of statements and a lot of things that Cohen was paranoid, he was taking medications, et cetera, all are irrelevant. Why are they irrelevant? Because the facts surrounding this, if I just wrote the story up and made it into a movie, you'd say it's impossible because those pings don't make any sense.
Yeah.
And the statement of him being followed and his nervousness, and then why would he say he was taking off his clothes? It all fits into this profile that I've talked about before. Unless his temperature was just going through the roof at that point. Now, I have stated on other shows that there's a statement out there in the world called being scared to death. And I think Cohen, if that was one case where that could apply, this would be it. But he was such a tough guy. What would have scared him that bad?
Right. And, you know, if you took this case singly, without looking at all the other cases around it, you could come up with a few different possible explanations. Maybe someone really was following him. Maybe they killed him in a way that isn't easily detectable. Maybe he was hallucinating and it eventually just literally scared him to death that, you know, he thought these things, that his greatest fears were coming after him or something. But when you look at it, as you said, in the context of all these other cases and in the context of previous disappearances in this area and the way the phone was pinged, it becomes such a puzzling case to add into all of this.
Exactly. And if it was me out there, I'd be running from two guys. But Cohen, I invite everybody to go look at his picture on Google and Yahoo. The guy was a stud. Whatever he saw out there, whatever was happening to him, would have scared the heck out of you and me if it scared him.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are other cases you have where people talk about seeing someone following them. You know, one of the things they come back with, they say, well, there were men following me in the woods, or I was scared because people were following me, but they don't really have any details on it.
No, they don't. And they can't offer any explanation as to what they meant, which is unusual.
Yeah, it almost feels like it's something that's just there in their head and they're repeating it, but they don't really understand it.
Exactly.
Well, you have definitely uncovered something bizarre and concerning, because, you know, this is a lot of people that are experiencing this, and this is just the ones you found.
Right.
No, so who knows? Go on.
And that's, I think, the major point here is that these are cases we've stumbled over in time, but the reality is we're probably, and George Knapp said this, he said, Dave, you're probably just scratching the surface. This has probably gone on for a lot longer than we both realize, and it's probably happened in environments that you're not looking at. And I mean, and he means, urban existences as well.
Right, which are harder to weed out this type of thing.
Yep.
Because people disappear in the city all the time, and a lot of times there's a perfectly prosaic explanation for it.
Or people are quick to point to, oh, you know, they were probably abducted or kidnapped, right?
Right. And it's harder to track people disappearing in the city as well. You can't say, well, they were on this mountain with no one else and there are no tracks and the dogs aren't finding anything. You don't have that availability of means of tracking in the city like that.
That's right.
What do you suggest people do? I mean, people shouldn't be afraid to go into parks and stuff, but what should they do to be aware that to be safe?
So I don't discourage people from going into our parks. I go there all the time, and I mean all the time. And a couple of things I do all the time is I always carry a personal locator transponder. Sometimes they're called a spot device. And what they are is they're similar to an EPIRB that you'd have on a boat that you register with our government. And in an emergency, you can push this button, sends a signal to the satellite. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration monitors these. And when an EPIRB or a personal transponder goes off, they contact emergency services in that area, and they go out and they search for you. So I carry one of those all the time. In the 5,000 cases I've researched, there's only one time where a person disappeared carrying one. Now, there's never been a case that we've seen where a person was carrying a spot device or a transponder and a firearm. Never. So it has to be your comfort level, but I always carry a gun everywhere. So going into the woods without a gun would, you know, be like going without underwear. I always carry one. So carry a firearm, carry a spot device, and always, always go with a partner.
Yeah, because very, very few people disappear in groups.
Very few.
Again, your website?
Can-Am, C-A-N as in Nora, A-M as in Mary, missing, canammissing.com. And you can watch our videos, look at the books, get a background on things, and keep up on current events.
And we should also be very clear, these books are not officially available on Amazon. People should buy them from your website, because people are selling them on Amazon for over double the cost that you're selling them for on the website.
Yeah, what's happened is that we made a choice that we would stay with our website since we developed it and we put in the fees to use it. Like right now, Missing 411 Eastern U.S. is $199.95 on Amazon. Come to our site, it's $24.95. So they're asking close to $100 for each one of our books or not, or more.
Yeah. So canammissing.com, that's like CanadianAmericanMissing.com.
That's it.
And the petition can be found at the bottom of the page where people can sign up and hopefully maybe get some accountability going for some of these missing people person cases.
Well, we can only hope, right?
Yeah. Is there anything else people should know?
You know, if you do hear about a case where somebody disappears and they're found in the mountains naked or without shoes, I would like to hear about that case. And
all right.
If you get a chance, get your library to order the books if you can't afford to buy it, and that way a lot of people have access to it, and we do get and we do sell a lot of books to libraries.
Okay, and there are four right now.
That's right.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for spending this time with us. I think what you're doing here is very important, and people should actually read the books. That don't go by what we've talked about here in the interview, saying you can't get a full feel for this unless you've actually read the cases in the books, because then you get that full picture of just how bizarre and hard to pin down this phenomena is.
I couldn't say it any better, Soraya. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, David.
It's always my pleasure.
And that concludes our two-part interview with David Politis here on Where Did the Road Go? I hope you enjoyed it. Again, it's really important that people go out and sign that petition. You can do so at canammissing.com, and you can do so on the in the show archive. There's a link to it on wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now, the next 2 weeks, I will have shows featuring listener stories of the paranormal, and I have some really interesting stories that you're going to hear. In fact, one of them, which was a very strange Bigfoot encounter, is going to be the entire show one of the next 2 weeks. I haven't done a show like this before. It's a little bit different than what you might hear on Jim Harrell's Campfire Stories, because I actually interview the person telling me the story a little bit. So it's a slightly different format. I didn't actually do this to copy Jim in any way, or ghost to ghost in any way. I was just being given so many interesting stories, I thought maybe it was time to have them given back to the overall audience. If there's time, I may even give you a few of my own interesting stories, which will eventually end up in a book I'm working on. And please, if you have any stories to share of your own, don't hesitate to shoot us an email or post it on our Facebook page or send us a Facebook message, whatever you prefer. Always interesting and interested in hearing people's experiences. And that's it for this week. Psyche Corporation, to take you out, this is Nightmares.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here, among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chew me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Let me burn, dear. doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Suffering, bitterness, suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a song.